Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that can't believe it has to say this, but organized crime is bad. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Dave Babbitt Jr. Actually, I'm Andrew Kanigeser.
Yes. So, welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, dissect it, look at the nuance, spoil the living hell out of it, talk about the metatext, the paratext, the subtext, or if it's just a complete godforsaken mess, just go into depth about that. The important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed on the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time in this little program of ours?
Last time, we were looking at the veritable showcase of the immortals. That was Frank Oz's The Score. And while it had a very notable cast, it also had a script by one Lem Dobbs, who we have decided to follow to a film that is notable for all the wrong reasons. If last time was a fluff piece to show great actors working together, this is either a fluff piece for one person and one person only, or an active filmed grieving session. That's right, we are looking at 2018's Gaudy. Yes, that one. Directed by Kevin Connolly, written by Leo Rossi and Lem Dobbs, and featuring a cast that really is a who's who of who's that, notably featuring John Travolta, Kelly Preston, and Stacy Keach. I'm going to go on a limb here and say that in spite of the reputation this film has gotten in certain circles, there's probably just as many people that have never heard of this film.
Well, yeah, and I mean, granted, had it gone through with its original release strategy, even less people would probably be aware of this. And that would probably be for the best.
Well, yeah. I mean, we, on our gimmick, part of it is the surprise of encountering films that we may not have ordinarily watched. But with that comes a great amount of risk. And we have seen films that have made us delighted, surprised, sometimes actively angry. And I don't know if we've ever watched a film that has made me feel the way I feel about Travolta's Gaudy.
And yeah, we're definitely going to have a lot to say about John Travolta, because man, oh man, is there a lot to say about John Travolta that comes through in this film.
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but we haven't looked at John Travolta previously, have we?
The closest we come was discussing him in terms of his work on Face Off during our Hard Target discussion.
And Broken Arrow. The classic 1-2 punch. Yeah, so I guess we've got a lot of ground to cover, and it's kind of unfortunate that this is our entry point onto John Travolta, who, for good or for ill, is one of the more notable actors of the last 30 or 40 years in America. But I mean, before we can get into Travolta, before we can get into a production history that will actually make you believe in curses, and before we can get into the film itself, we should all probably get on the same page. And the best way for us to do that is throw it over to Dave, who's going to give us the rundown.
Gaudy is the infamous 2018 biopic about notorious New York mobster John Gaudy. Produced by and starring John Travolta in the role of John Gaudy, the film covers Gaudy's rise to the head of the Gambino crime family while navigating his relationships with his wife and children. Directed by Kevin Connolly from a script by Leo Rossi and Lem Dobbs, Gaudy was a critical and box office disaster upon release. Coming up after film strips, Matthew Lillard stars in the pilot episode of Cujo, the series.
So I guess to begin looking at a film like Gaudy, I mean, there's a lot of avenues that we can go. We were talking on the break that it probably makes most sense, as bizarre as this film is, to place it within the context of John Travolta's overall career arc. And I think it's safe to say that we are firmly in the denouement period of that arc. Is that fair?
I would say it's fair, with the caveat that the thing with John Travolta, if you look over his career, it is basically a case of one man who manages to rise to great heights and then find ways to self-sabotage on levels that are unmistakably grave, and then manages to find ways to get himself out of the hole somewhat for a while, only to crater his career once again afterwards.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, we're children of the 1980s. We were born in that decade. And, I mean, like, when we were born, John Travolta had... Because what year does Saturday Night Fever come out? 76?
I think it's 78. Or 77, 78 is when that one comes out. And then it's part of the 1-2 punch that he has with Grease as well. And this is also at the time where he was on a hit television show, Welcome Back, Kotter, which, I mean, I'm not sure how many people these days are familiar with it, but that thing was huge.
Well, and even, when does De Palma make Carrie? Is that 79 or 81, I want to say?
That is 75, I believe, that was when that one comes out.
That early, Well, I mean, that just, sort of speaks to the point that, by the time you and I were born, John Travolta had already been both, kind of an actor who had found success playing, a young character, while at the same time, a movie like Saturday Night Fever is more dramatic than you think it would be from the outset. And I mean, by the time you get to the 1980s, there's sort of that other pivot to Travolta as a grown-up, mature actor, and then, a comedy actor. And then in the 90s, you get Pulp Fiction, where it's reinvented once again as a legitimate, cool actor, and then the rest of it is just slowly unwinding while we wait for another comeback.
Well, this is the thing, and I think it's very important because, yeah, we were born in the 80s, but we definitely grew up with Travolta in the 90s. And
yeah,
Travolta in the 90s, once Pulp Fiction, I remember as a kid, here's the thing to remember. When I say that Travolta's career, hit some really high marks in the 1970s, I do mean he hit, the highest of highs as you can go with that 1-2 punch of Grease and Saturday Night Fever. The problem is, even though they're, I think his best work is in a film like Blowout from 1980, and, he also has Urban Cowboy, which sort of balances out in terms of box office performance. The thing is that he then went on a string of significant bombs following that, with things such as the, not necessarily an outright bomb, but Staying Alive, the notorious Sylvester Stallone-directed sequel to Saturday Night Fever, which we have to cover one day, Two of a Kind, his reuniting with Olivia Newton-John, which is a debacle, to put it mildly.
Wait a sec. I don't know about Two of a Kind. All right, so on a scale of Xanadu to Grease 2, where does it rank?
It does not even hit remotely on either of those things. Okay, Xanadu is legitimately fun, and Grease 2 is a film that I will go to bat as saying it's better than Grease, because I'm not really a Grease person.
Oh, God, no, David. Don't let your goodness poison your brain. All right, we're going to sit down, maybe for Christmas this year, we'll look at both Grease movies, and we'll do it on New Year's so we can release it as a live recording.
Fair enough. Point being here that, Two of a Kind is awful. But beyond that, he went on to a string of bombs from there, including Perfect with Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yes, that's the one I was trying to think of. The expose on fitness centers.
But the big thing is when I was young, I remember he had sort of a comeback in the very late 80s, early 90s with the film Look Who's Talking. Yes. And its two sequels. And yeah, this was things I remember my parents renting that and that being like a families getting together and watch it. But it was also a point where John Travolta had gone from being, again, Saturday Night Fever and working with Brian De Palma to doing these family movies about the inner worlds of babies, co-starring with Christy Alley.
Well, yeah, it's from Saturday Night Fever to Saturday Night Live type material, And I mean, that's one of those moves, though, where, it's not necessarily a comeback, but you definitely feel this sense that there's momentum in the studio where it's like, okay, well, people at least buy John Travolta as a funny dad humor type. Let's go with this for a while. And so, it's weird because Travolta, on the one hand, is so easily caricatured and unmistakable in his features, and certainly in his life post-2000 in his mannerisms. But, there's something very chameleonic about him as well.
Well, it's the thing where, he's had, the phases of his career are very distinct. Because once you get to the tail end of this, 1994 happens, and Quentin Tarantino casts him in Pulp Fiction. And again, I think it's very hard for people who weren't around in 1994 to understand just what a seismic bomb that was on pop culture. And I'm saying this as somebody who, at the time that comes out, I would have been 9 or 10, depending upon the exact release date, and I didn't get to see the film at that point, not for a few years.
Yeah, my cousin had the poster of Uma on the wall, and I'm like, I have no idea what this film's title means or what it's about.
Well, and that's exactly it, but it was everywhere, and again, even if you hadn't seen the film, even if you were a 10-year-old kid in Ontario, you know, you would see, the whole John Travolta dancing, doing the Watusi on the dance floor.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like, every phase of Travolta's career has also been parodied on The Simpsons. There you go, Ross. It's,
yeah.
Yeah, but, like, it's also interesting because, like, 1994, I mean, by that point, John Travolta, even though he's coming off a string of failures, is a much bigger name than Quentin Tarantino. So, like, in the reception and, like, fan circles of the time, like, Pulp Fiction, in a weird way, is seen almost as more, like, a John Travolta film than a Quentin Tarantino one. And, I mean, it's also kind of highlighted by the fact that Pulp Fiction's success really, to me, like, as a filmgoer, is, like, that's sort of that moment where the Oscars and Cannes collide, while at the same time audiences pay to see that movie regardless.
Well, this is, yeah, definitely where the idea of Hollywood indie hits mainstream hard in a way that we really haven't seen since basically the end of sort of Miramax in its original form, as were. That's not to boast Harvey and Bob Weinstein there, folks, okay? It's just acknowledging what the reality of the situation was at the time. May they never come back. Point being,
love the production company, hate the producers.
Exactly. But the big thing here is that with Pulp Fiction, John Travolta ends up going on to probably, I think, what we can arguably say is the best phase of his career for the next 5 or 6 years, where he has a string of really big and phenomenal films under his belt that people liked. I mean, Get Shorty, which is probably the most distinct one in my mind from my youth, because I saw that one before Pulp Fiction. And yeah, I mean, that was the film that not only, you know, was a huge mega success, but I think for a generation of us, introduced us to Elmore Leonard. Please remember his name.
Yeah, there's, and I mean, it. I think it also helps that Elmore Leonard, as a writer, there is something delightfully pulpy about his novels as well. So it exists, even though it's like much more of a comedic film than Pulp Fiction. There's sort of a continuum that they both fit on.
Well, exactly. And then you go on to do things like Phenomenon, a film I, again, have distinct memories of renting as a child and bawling my eyes out at the very end of it.
Was he also in Michael, and are they not basically the same thing?
They're very similar, and they were released around the exact same time, so they're very easy to...
So it's Angels versus Aliens, right?
There is no... spoilers for Phenomenon, folks. There are no aliens. He just has cancer, but we'll put that aside for now. Putting that aside, he basically has this run where he's working with respectable directors, doing things like Primary Colors, The General's Daughter, like big real things, and you know, he gets all this momentum going for himself, and so much so that eventually, this leads to basically the year 2000, when John Travolta's 20-year-in-the-making passion project was finally able to get off the ground. And the reason
that movie called, David?
Battlefield Earth.
Yes, it was.
Let's be clear, because this opens up a couple things that we really need to sort of address, because...
Well, this is why 2000 is also a pretty critical turning point in sort of Travolta discourse, because... Yeah. After this point, not only do his career choices seem different, but also his personal life comes under much stricter scrutiny.
Yes, and the thing about it here is that Travolta is somebody who, I as far as I can tell from all the research I've done, he's always had people asking questions about his personal life in a variety of degrees. Including on things that really aren't the public's business in terms of his sexuality.
Yes. I mean, there's a couple things going on in Travolta's life, some of which are confirmed, namely the fact that he is a member of the Church of Scientology.
Yeah,
and that's... That he Also, I think we would be remiss to not note the recent passing of Kelly Preston, who also appears in this film, which is sad because they were married for a very long time. And as we will get into, they also both survived one of their children as well. And unfortunately, yeah. That does form a big subtext in how we read this film, and I think a way that the viewer is meant to read this film. But like, I don't know, it like, that's not to say that you absolutely need to know everything or who Travolta is deep down to make sense of his work, but also like that conversation, it grows to a kind of critical mass where that is a returning theme in discourse anytime a movie of his comes out after 2000. It seems that every time he announces a new project is coming out, more of the discussion is relitigating whether or not long circulating rumors about his sexuality matter, or whether or not he's been brainwashed into a cult. And like, as a result, much less attention gets paid to the movies themselves, in a way.
Well, and the thing is, to a degree, I agree with you. I would also say, though, that the big difference between Gaudi and Battlefield Earth is because these are films that he is a producer on, and he was gung-ho on making these things because they were very personal projects for him.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so weird, because these films almost invite that kind of reading, whereas you and I, we've said many, many times in many different episodes that normally we typically don't go for that kind of biographical reading of films.
Yeah, and that normally wouldn't be work, but here, there's just no way to get away from it. And
he's telling us to, effectively, so it's like, who are we to say that he's wrong? If anyone knows what he's doing, it's presumably John Travolta.
Well, yeah, so the thing with, basically, Battlefield Earth was, again, yes, John Travolta notoriously belongs to the Church of Scientology, and if you don't know who those guys are, basically...
Literally every podcast other than ours talks about the history of Scientology. It's okay, Dave. Let's assume our listeners know the big things about it.
Yeah, very dubious religion, started by a guy named L. Ron Hubbard, who probably was a con man.
Yeah. Rent the Master, it's more fun than we will be about it.
Yeah. The big thing here about L. Ron Hubbard is that he was also, along with inventing his religion, he also wrote this novel, Battlefield Earth, because he was a terrible science fiction writer. It is one of the few sci-fi novels I made the effort to read where I gave up after 50 pages. It is so awful. But
yeah, I've never read Hubbard's work. I don't see the need to, but I gather he's kind of like Ayn Rand, where it's like, instead of being a good novelist or a good philosopher, you just kind of mashed the two together and did them both poorly.
Yeah. And the thing is that John Travolta really was desperate to bring Battlefield Earth to screen. And so much so that he basically, you know, he tried to get it made in the 1980s where he would have played the lead character, and finally by 2000 had enough clout to get the financing to make this big, what he saw as going to be this big sci-fi epic tribute to L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of this religion that apparently is very meaningful to him.
Yeah, and now it's not the case where the film is meant to be like an advert for Scientology, but I mean, you run into that problem, especially because Scientology itself, you know, has sort of like, you know, one of the member duties is to promote the organization. So, I mean, it would be like making a film about, oh, I don't know, Tommy Douglas, but not... trying to not mention healthcare.
Well, exactly. So, okay, you think, all right, fine, big sci-fi adventure movie. What could possibly go wrong? Well, A, if you read the book, you know that there's a lot that can go wrong, because it is basically a mashup of a lot of very generic pulp sci-fi ideas, but, again, poorly written and on an epic scale that is absurd. And Travolta ends up gathering together a crew to make this film, including, I believe it was George Lucas's assistant director on the Phantom Menace,
okay,
to direct this movie, and a cast that was filled out with people like Barry Pepper, Canada's Own, Kim Coates, Canada's Own, Kelly Preston, I'm noticing a pattern here, Forrest Whitaker, who really deserves so much better.
Man, that guy loves acting.
Yeah. What the end result is basically one of the biggest, most laughed out debacles that you can imagine. And I actually rewatched it prior to recording this episode just to remind myself what this thing's like. And it is a masterpiece of ineptness on a level that you have to see to believe.
Yeah, and that's... I only, like, I just want to say that that is sort of, it's similar to Gaudi, where on the one hand, when Battlefield Earth came out and, like, got such a, it, like, not just a negative reaction, it got eviscerated by the critics and by fans and by audiences. And the thing is, like, it struck me as, like, kind of bad taste, because I'm like, how much of this is people just dunking on Scientology or dunking on Travolta the person rather than the film itself? And then you watch the film and you realize, no, it actually is that bad.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, this is basically a case where you get the... And partly the thing is as you're watching, because this is Travolta's passion project, and you can tell watching every frame that there was nobody... telling him no at any point, whether it was the director saying, John, you might want to dial your performance down a little bit, or John, that's not the way that jets work, or John, this is not how radiation works, or
John, why are we looping the guy saying infinite options for renewal?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there is any choice that is made in that film, they not only made the wrong choice, they doubled down on the wrong choice hard in every instance. And that's the thing. John Travolta is...
No, I think that's an important thing to mark, though, because especially in Gaudi, there seems to be something actively confrontational against the viewer. And in the way this film was marketed, very literally as... why aren't the critics reviewing Gaudi? What don't they want you to know, right? Like, it kind of comes full for here, sort of begins in Battlefield, where a lot of great people in the world would benefit so much from that person saying, not this time. And Travolta doesn't have that. And so instead, like, because he believes in what he's doing, anyone telling him no, like, he responds with, oh yeah, watch and learn. But he is not a master director. He is not a master producer. He is debatably even a capable actor anymore. And it's just like, man, why? Why are you doing this to yourself?
Well, and this is the thing. And I listened to an interview from John Travolta from late last year that he did with a podcast, and I won't name the podcast because generally I like the show, but it's an interview where you can very much tell, it's very explicit. The people conducting the interview are hardcore John Travolta fans, no, and they're not really challenging him on anything. And John Travolta pretty much straight up admits that the reason he's agreed to this interview is because it's like, oh, you guys all get it. You all get everything about me. And the thing that comes very clear from listening to this interview is I don't think John Travolta has been outside his own bubble in a long time. He has been, probably because he can afford to, but he doesn't really have to. He's somebody who's basically bought into his own hype and his own beliefs surrounding himself.
You can say that about a lot of people, David, and, like, not to make excuses necessarily, but I think Travolta is on a different tier than, say, someone like Michael Jackson, who became famous for insularity. Yeah. And maybe that's because, you know, as far as I know, Travolta has had no allegations of, like, illegality in his life. It's not a crime to not be... What? There is?
I would say,
God.
I would say that there are some questions from the early 2010s surrounding activities at massage parlors and accusations made against him. I will say no more than that, folks. Wikipedia exists.
Haven't heard active. I guess what I'm trying to say is, without condemning or condoning, at the same time, when you are someone who has had as many high-profile failures as John Travolta did in quick succession, and things like your sexuality are constantly the subject of, like, late-night TV jokes, I can understand not wanting to leave your house either.
Well, I will give him that fairness. It just seems that, particularly listening to an interview, it's somebody who's, like, he basically is somebody who craves admiration and basically wants, he looks for confirmation that he's always made the right choice. Any circumstance.
It's dangerous to confuse psychofancy with respect.
Well, and that's exactly it. Now, the big thing is, yes, starting from Battlefield Earth, we begin the sort of decline of Travolta over the course of the 2000s, where he ends up starring in basically a series of either mediocre or films or really modest hits at best, including a film that I'm sure one of these days we'll get to, Jonathan Henslin's, if I remember his name correctly, The Punisher from 2004, starring
Jane. The worst one, actually, and yes, I'm counting the other ones. It's like a 2.5-hour somber music video for a terrible song by Amy Lee.
Yeah, we'll get to that one day. Travolta does apparently still defend that movie. That's neither here nor there.
Because isn't one of the major plot points the fact that Will Patton's a closeted homosexual?
Like I said, we'll get to Punisher 2004 one of these days. Yeah. Point
we're
being here,
off gaudy, if you couldn't tell. But yeah, so there's that. I'm trying to think. He has the cameo in Austin Powers Goldmember.
Yeah, he has the Be Cool, the sequel to Get Shorty that nobody remembers, and with good reason.
Well, it's remembered as a bomb. Let's see, what else is there? Domestic Disturbance with Vince Vaughn.
Probably the one highlight for him in terms of financial success was Swordfish, the Hugh Jackman, Halle Berry, John Travolta film. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Swordfish is not a smart or necessarily good movie. I think Travolta actually gives a solid performance.
It's been so long since I watched it. I can't honestly feel...
He's clearly trying to do his own take on, like, a Cruise Collateral type role. But yeah. I think he's slick enough to pull it off for the most part, as I remember. Maybe it's just because the rest of the film is so terrible.
Well, that's possible. I mean, I will be happy to rewatch it once it hopefully ends up on Netflix again. But the big thing here is I think the real major turning point and the thing we have to address isn't really so much a big screen issue, because generally it follows that pattern of declining returns and success, both critically and financially for him. It's 2009 when his son, teenage son, Jet Travolta, passes away at this point in time. I believe it was related to seizures, was what was basically...
It was an unanticipated death, that much I can say. Yeah, and I mean, obviously this is a significant personal tragedy, regardless of one's philosophy or worldview or career choices. It is profoundly sad whenever a parent has to bury their child. And, you know, I mean, that's not to say that personal sadness gets you off the hook for everything. But, I mean, especially going into Gotti, that I think becomes very important to note as something that would go on to affect Travolta quite visibly in the years that followed.
Well, and this is the thing, because I mean, when you look at the choices he's made over the last decade, I think the big things to keep in mind is, like, a lot of aging stars, particularly the ones who were the mega stars of the 90s, who haven't been able to adapt either to becoming supporting character actors or who really don't know their place in the industry anymore. He's found sort of a home with these, I'm trying to think about how you describe. Generally, they're either premium video on demand or straight to DVD films, but being produced by companies like Millennium Entertainment, VVS. These are the ones where you see like 13 different studio logos from companies you don't recognize unless you're watching these things at the front of it. And they're usually these very modestly budgeted films, but which serve as sort of an outlet for, it basically becomes sort of homes for aging actors, as it were. And he's made things such as, I watched...
Yeah, like, it's not B-Row, but we have enough of a budget that it it looks respectable, and we can give you a poster that looks like it's going to be a much better movie.
Well, exactly. And there's things like, I mean, I, again, as part of this sort of mini Travolta-thon I sort of went through in prep for this episode, I watched the film Killing Season that he did with Robert De Niro, dealing with an American soldier and I believe and another soldier who survived the Bosnian War and who have a very personal connection with one another. And it's, again, it's a serviceable small-scale thriller from Mark Steven Johnson, of all people.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, I mean, he's only the director on it, which probably means why it's more coherent than anything that he wrote and directed prior to this. But, I mean, it's also one of these films where you can tell it's like they... Basically, this is a film where the majority of the paycheck went to Travolta and De Niro, and it's basically two dudes out in the mountains filming a thriller that runs 80 minutes, but thank you, you know, we got 10 minutes worth of credits to toss on at the end to reach that 90 point, so it looks longer than it is. But that's the thing, where a lot of his stuff has sort of ended up that way, and we haven't really seen, like, Travolta as a big screen star hasn't really been the thing. Like, most high-profile thing he did was, I believe it was American Crime Story, like, that did the O.J. Simpson trial, where he played, in it?
Was it Robert Shapiro? No, that was David Schwimmer.
Yeah, he's one of the lawyers, I think, if I remember correctly. Honestly, I haven't actually watched the series. I do remember, though, again, a lot of people were sitting there saying, John Travolta being very theatrical in this movie, or in this show.
Well, he was also in Hairspray, where he played the mom, and that... Yeah. Obviously, it raised a whole lot of questions surrounding the release of that, and I don't remember anyone ever talking about that film again. Which, I mean, it's just case in point where it seems like an unforced error, where you're either deliberately flaunting, like, kind of certain things to get people talking about it, or you are so unaware that, like, you are incapable of seeing how making these choices reinforces every rumor that has dogged you through your career.
Well, and it's the thing where, again, I think, and again, the reason we, I guess, focus on the rumors here is it's if that is who John Travolta is, that's not an issue. That
exactly.
Nobody cares about it. It's like, and this is the thing, it's just between what is known of Scientology and its approach to things, and basically, you know, the risks of internalized self-hatred, you know, it does beg a lot of questions of what's going on under the surface there with Travolta.
I mean, even
as
if you subtract Scientology, if that's even possible, like, I think even in a more base sense than that, like, I don't know, it seems that every time that question comes up, like, before she passed, Carrie Fisher, you know, had a high-profile interview where she, at least in her own mind, was absolutely certain that Travolta is a closeted gay man, and more or less decided to do him the favor of outing him, which, thanks, Carrie. The problem is, every time that happens, it seems that he then invests further in making a film like this that doubles down on toughness, hypermasculinity, this kind of, like, reactionary hand of the fatherism, and it's like, it really comes off as an overcorrection.
And the thing is, that's probably the better side of this movie in terms of its personal connections to Travolta, if that's where we're going with it. But the reality is, okay, we can't avoid Gaudi forever.
I mean, I think this stuff is important to note, especially if you are, like, say, a younger film viewer, because it's very easy to lose sight of the fact that John Travolta in 2020 is very different from who John Travolta was even in, say, 1997. Right, both as a person, as a public figure, as a certain celebrity persona nexus, right?
Well, and that's the thing. And, I mean, and it really comes to a head, with Gaudi, his next big personal project. Now, the thing is, Gaudi doesn't begin with John Travolta. I mean,
no.
So probably the first thing we should note here is, who is John Gaudi, Andrew, and what would be the quick and dirty version of that?
John Gaudi is, in some ways, like the last of the high-profile American mafiosos. He was involved with the Gambino crime family operating largely out of New York, worked his way through the ranks. He was sort of like a good public face for American organized crime because he had a very strong sense of style and a very strong sense of optics and its media presence. Ultimately, he was indicted three different times after he ended up taking over the Gambino organization. And in every time, allegedly through various nefarious means, he was acquitted. That gave him the nickname the Teflon Don. However, it was short-lived because they ended up coming back with a fourth indictment that stuck, and then he died in prison of throat cancer in 2002. But in many respects, like, he is both sort of the end of an era in some respects, but also, as you and I were talking about when we had the good fortune to meet and go for coffee over the last week, like, it feels like in order for someone like John Gotti to have any importance whatsoever, you need to be somebody John Travolta's age, because by the time we grew up and were old enough to know who John Gotti was, we knew him as the guy that was going to die in prison, who later died in prison.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, John Gotti was very much a significant figure for a very specific point in time, in a very specific area.
I believe they
area.
Already have made several movies about Gotti. I remember even in the 90s, there was, I think HBO did the one with Armand Assante.
Yes, they did, which, yeah, we name-checked back when we were doing our Phil Spector episode, where we should also note, yes, John Gotti's lawyer during one of his trials was Bruce Cutler.
Everything flows together. Our show's gimmick stays relevant. But
exactly.
Yeah, it's just like, I guess the point is for me, it's like, on the one hand, like, as we'll very quickly summarize, Gotti is a film that has the rare dual phenomenon of development hell and distribution hell, it seems. And all of this cannot answer the central question of why, even in, like, by 2010, are you going to beat the dead horse of a John Gotti biopic?
Well, the basic thing is when this film begins development, it's more or less, as I understand it, though I don't remember seeing it listed in the credits as such, is effectively based on a book looked by John Gotti Jr. and his sort of relationship with his father. Because Gotti Jr. as well is a member of the same crime family, and that becomes very important. And for a while, this film gets its sort of beginnings in 2010, and at first goes through, you know, seems to like it's going to be made by Barry Levinson. Again, somebody we name-checked when we did Phil Spector, because he was the executive producer on that one, and also directed the HBO films Paterno and You Don't Know Jack. And Levinson is a very respected director. Maybe not a high-profile one these days, but a very respected director, and in and out throughout the course of its development, there were versions of this project where there were going to be high-profile names attached to it, including at one point the looks like they were actually going to successfully get Joe Pesci out of retirement to come in and play Angelo, Gotti's right-hand man, in the course of this.
And instead, he decided to do it for The Irishman. So I guess time will tell what was the better move.
Well, exactly. But, I mean, okay, you have names like Pesci. You have names like Pacino. You have names, like, in terms of directors, after Barry Levinson, we had Nick Cassavetes, who did John Q in The Notebook, and yes, is the son of John Cassavetes and Gina Roland. Who, and again, wouldn't say a great director, but there's a track record. He has success with things. And again, you know, we can't overstate the success of The Notebook when that film was released.
Yeah, I always thought they missed a trick by not making the official Notebook of The Notebook, which is just like a standard notebook, but in the corner, it's like a flip book. So on the first page, it's Ryan Gosling, and the last page is James Garner, and you slowly watch time's cruel effect. But yeah, like a lot of different names are attached to the project. I think you sent it to me in a text. I forget just how many, but like a staggering number of people come and go. This is like live action Akira. Who do they end up getting to direct it though? And I think given some of the names we've been throwing around, who they ultimately settle on really kind of paints a picture.
Okay, so yeah, so eventually, and as I understand it, and maybe I'm getting the timeline wrong, John Travolta does sign on to both produce the movie and star in it, and the director ultimately settled on is a man by the name of Kevin Connolly. Now, Connolly is a name you might sort of be familiar with if you were a fan of a television show called Entourage, of which he was one of the stars of it. I was not. However, he has been a longtime actor and director in television, including directing episodes of Unhappily Ever After.
Which he also starred on, or was part of the recurring cast, now.
Yes, he was. So he was definitely part of that. He directed episodes of Entourage, which he was also part of the cast, episodes of the web series version of Snatch, and something called The Oath recently, which I have no idea what that is. He was also accused of sexual assault back in 2005, most recently, from the premiere of his one film, Dear Eleanor, from back in 2005. So, yeah.
But we're in a pantheon of heroes here. And so writing the film, though, we have Lem Dobbs returning, who, as we talked about last week, has this odd dual tendency where, on the one hand, Dobbs has written some pretty good and, like, tight crime or sort of hard-nosed scripts, but also seems to be just as happy working as a script doctor. We see both of those tendencies at play here.
Yes, Dobbs did basically, from what I understand, was brought in to do the final few passes at the script. The majority of, from what I understand, of the hard work on this film, though, was done by the other credited writer, Leo Rossi. Now, if you're wondering who the hell Leo Rossi is, well, you probably don't know him as a writer because the only other thing I can find that he wrote was something called Mafioso, the Father, the Son.
Which honestly could have been the subtitle of Gotti.
Exactly. But you probably do know him as an actor who, A, is in this film, we'll get to his role, but B, is probably forever known to me as the very sketchy and sleazy hospital male nurse / ambulance attendant from Halloween 2, the Rick Rosenthal one, not Rob Zombie's one. So, yeah, as you can already tell, we're getting the cream of the crop involved in this film in terms of A-list talent from where we started. And then we look at the rest of this cast that's brought together to shoot this thing, and you start to notice a pattern here, because in addition to Leo Rossi, who I'm sure was very happy to cash two checks on this one.
Lunch Lady Doris syndrome.
Yeah. In the role of Angelo, instead of, say, Joe Pesci, who actually sued the producers of this film when they tried to recast him in another role, we have...
An actor of Italian descent, maybe. Someone who can do a good Italian accent. I mean, his name is Angelo Ruggiero.
Instead, we get Pruitt Taylor Vince. We'll get to his performance. Yes, we get Chris Mulkey, who as Frank DeCicio, if I'm not botching his name.
Yep, who we'll also know from the Pacific Northwest as Hank, Norma's husband on Twin Peaks, who looks exactly the same.
Yes, Kelly Preston, who prior to this film hadn't acted in a while, and again, John Travolta's wife.
And this would end up being her final film role.
Yes, Stacy Keach. God bless Stacy Keach. One of the hardest working men in Hollywood.
He looks like he died about 30 days before filming started.
But he still, despite that fact, he's the one bright spot in this movie, folks, in terms of acting. I will say that.
Yeah, and I think if you and I come down anywhere, it'll be Stacy Keach, you deserve so much more.
Exactly. And last but not least, and definitely, we're going to talk about him, a young actor by the name of Spencer LaFranco, who plays John Gotti Jr. We'll get to him, and we don't mean to be mean, is what I will say in advance. But
maybe you might not. But I mean, like, I summarized the life story of John Gotti pretty neatly. But honestly, unless you are really invested in the twists and turns of who owned what part of the Gambino family and when, that's really the entire story of the film. It's not terribly interesting. But you wouldn't know it from how it begins, would you, David?
Well, here's the thing, and what is one of the bad signs for this movie, we get two frame narratives here, okay? Let's start with the first one, which is a John Gotti, as played by John Travolta, sans makeup at this point, so basically what John Travolta looks like more or less these days, standing in front of, I believe it's the Brooklyn Bridge.
It's the Annie Hall backdrop.
Yeah.
Only they couldn't spring for Keaton.
And it's at nighttime, and he's basically talking about how New York is the best city on earth. this was my city, I ruled it, and that can end one of two ways. Either you fall down or you're dead. And in both cases, or you end up in jail or you're dead. And in both cases, they happen to me.
Well, no, it's not quite that clunky. Is this life, you either, it's all about the life in this movie. And in the life, you either, you end it one of two ways. In jail or dead. I did both. But, like, what strikes you is how immediately over the top, immediately, like, regressive and in your face it is, and immediately how much Travolta is desperately trying to project, like, I'm living the character here.
Yeah, and again, that interview I listened to with Travolta, he goes all into the process of the research and the depth and how he tries to become the character and how you have to try and be able to think like the character. Yeah, you could see he's trying that here.
What does that even mean? Oh, I bet John Gotti would stand in front of the bridge like this. But, like, you know, we've joked in previous episodes that even when you know you're watching a bad movie, like, it's really fun in the first 5 seconds to lean over and be like, it's pretty good so far. You can't do that with this movie, because it begins with Travolta angrily turning around and yelling at you.
And it only goes downhill from here, because we then cut to, basically, what we'll discover is somebody in a, you know, a Joker purple level suit being brought in handcuffs and on a dolly, basically, into a prison here. And again, if you're sitting here thinking, yeah, oh, this is Arkham Asylum, this film took a hell of a turn, believe me, I wish it had. Instead, what it turns out is that we are seeing John Gotti Jr., a.k.a. John A., played by LaFranco, coming in to meet his father in 1999 in prison. And at this point, John Gotti Sr., as played by Travolta, and one of the few things you can say nice about this movie, the makeup they gave him is pretty impressive.
And to Travolta's credit, I mean, he at least tilts his performance with age better than you might think.
Yeah, and basically at this point, Gotti Sr. is riddled with cancer. He's dying, effectively.
But his son faces a choice, right? He is under threat of indictment. The prosecutors are taking a hard line. They are basically offering him a deal. If he pleads out, he will serve 5 to 7 years of his sentence, and then he'll be a free man, and he can be, like, a part of his children's lives. He can fight it, but if he loses, he could be looking at 20 years. And, naturally, the schism is not, I will support my son, I will understand, I will help him make better choices than me. This is Travolta pounding his fist on a table and saying, well, what are they offering you, 5.5, or is it 7? What does that mean? I'm not all sophisticated like you. All I know is you don't snitch on the family. Be a man. That ends up being the operative theme of this film. If there is a theme to this film, much more than anything it is about Gotti the man or anything we can learn, it's that real men don't talk. And that's a very weird theme, and a even weirder when you place that in the larger connection to Travolta's own life.
As I noted at the start of the episode, the mob are not nice people by any stretch of the imagination.
And I mean, there is a very, like, it's more than that, right? Like, there is a very real, you know, harm that can sometimes be done through cinematic representations. Like, the idea of criminals in the modern day being influenced by The Godfather and Scarface, or the idea that, you know, everyone started holding their pistol sideways because that's what happened in Menace to Society. Like, it becomes part of a feedback loop, right? But, and I mean, that's fine. I assume most viewers are sensible and responsible. But at the same time, I think when you're recasting organized crime as the Robin Hood of the modern day, especially with a person like John Gotti, I think that borders on irresponsible.
Oh, I will go one further. This is an irresponsible movie. But the thing, I will say this, two things. Number one, it should not surprise anybody that the Gotti family cooperated very willingly with this film and were very happy with it in terms of its presentation. So take that for what you will. The other thing, though, and this is the thing, it's not even like this movie presents Gotti as a Robin Hood figure, robbing from the rich and giving to the poor and helping the community. The most we see is like him ordering his goons to help an old lady across the street in this film.
Yeah. Or, hey, I lit off a bunch of fireworks. And then all these other guys are like, hey, Gotti, you the man, baby. You're my homie, Gotti.
Yeah. The rest of this film basically illustrates that John Gotti Sr. went around murdering people to make his way up the mob, organized hits on open restaurants in front of people, basically was verbally abusive towards his family.
Well, yeah, this is a film that wants to have it both ways, though, where because all of that is made okay by the fact that, you know, Gotti always insists he's a man with a code, but like, it doesn't sustain itself because at one and the same time, half of Gotti's story is that when other people try and rock the boat, he insists on honoring the code, honoring the life, honoring the rules. You know, he chews out one of his soldiers for visiting another made man's wife without somebody else present. Yeah. And I mean, that was the one interesting thing I learned, where it's like, don't you ever be seen with a made man's wife when you're alone. You understand me? But at the same time, he is also the one pounding his fist on the table when Stacy Keach, as his mentor and consigliere, Neil, is like, well, no, you can't jump the chain and whack the boss. And he says, nah, that guy doesn't know what it's like. That guy doesn't know what it's like to be a leader and be down in the trenches. It's my time, and I'm taking the reins. It's like, so which is it? Honor the rules or play by your own? Because he's doing both of those things, and the film never seems to address that contradiction.
Well, and look, here's the, this is the thing. Like even doing a scene-by-scene discussion of this movie is kind of pointless, because the film, it follows a general arc, and the scenes are so repetitious. But the general thing about this movie is, yeah, it's structured around Gotti basically serving under, in this instance, Neil Kuros? I'm not entirely sure.
Let me see the last name. I'll give it her a kick. Oh, I'm feeling very European. Delacroce.
Yeah, Delacroce. And that's played by Stacy Keach. And yes, basically, Delacroce was somebody who would have been up to run for the family, except somebody else got there first.
Most of the characters in the film are real people, not just amalgams necessarily. And yeah, Delacroce was the underboss, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, and the film makes it a point to flesh him out a bit and just be like, you know, the thing about Neil is if he ever wanted to take over at any point, he easily could have. The family would have like backed him, but he never did because he respected the system.
Exactly. And the whole thing is that Gotti doesn't see what's worth respecting with the higher ups because, as he sees it, they're basically just money men who aren't really living the life and are just operating at a distance more than anything else. Yeah. Now,
and there's this implicit thread, though, that Gotti is sort of like the new generation of organized crime. But that's completely not borne out, by the fact that his criminal operations remain exactly as the mob has always been. But also, like, from frame one, even in the flashbacks where it's supposed to show, like, how cool and hip Gotti's crew is, Travolta's the only one who has any kind of age makeup. So it's him standing on a street corner in, like, dumb black leather jackets with Pruitt, Taylor, Vince, and Chris Mulkey. And I'm just like, oh, I guess they're here to pick up their grandkids from the crime pub or something like that. Like, it's just so bizarre. Where it's one thing to have, like, the Goodfellas scene at the Copa, where it's all this dazzling cinematography and hot jazz and cool outfits and showing Frank Sinatra and everyone's coming through the back room and everybody knows Henry Hill's name. And then suddenly we see Travolta and his goons standing on a corner being like, you let that guy cut into my garment sales?
Well, this is the thing. Number one, like, again, you can't get around the fact that John Travolta is somebody in his 60s at this point in time. There's just, even with all the good makeup they do put on him to make him look a little bit younger, he doesn't look like somebody who's in his 20s or 30s.
You can make someone look older a lot easier than you can make someone look young.
Yeah, there's a reason why only Marvel can afford to do digital de-aging, for God's sakes. I mean, but in this case, okay, so there's our problem number one. Okay, we have that plot line going on throughout the film, and it's generic mob stuff for the most part. Then we come across to the personal life of Gotti, where Okay, as they're shooting, we have his wife being played by Kelly Preston here, Victoria. And we see that, you know, Gotti's got like three kids. They're all, you know, rambunctious and individuals. And then what ends up happening is in one scene, his one son is riding on his bike out in the street, out in the neighborhood, and basically someone, a neighbor comes by and hits the kid when he wasn't paying attention while driving.
Yeah, and this is taken from real life, as was the ensuing disappearance of said neighbor, presumed murdered by Gotti's crew. But, like, from the moment that scene begins, though, the parallel editing on display, you immediately know what's going to happen. And, oh my god, like, you can't see a scene like this in a film backed by John Travolta in 2018 without reading what follows as very much kind of filming through it, in a sense. But even prior to that, like, because it's the son Frankie is the one who dies?
I believe so, yes.
Because what ends up happening is, though, like, John A., like, this film's pacing is so inexpert that, like, we're trying to put this film in a better order than it presents itself. Because, yeah, like, with those flashbacks, like, before we even get flashbacks, we see discussions with John A. We see young John A. talking with his father. And then we meet Frankie, who then we get a little bit of dialogue to talk about how special he is. And then he dies. And then we have 15 minutes of protracted grieving on screen. And, like, a long, like, this is where Kelly Preston pretty much only really has her featured scenes, and most of them are just her holding her husband or being held by her husband while they cry very anguished over their dead child. And I don't know how I can respond to that as a viewer, other than I just hope that if this film is meant to be a sort of therapy for yourself, I hope that at least it turned into what you wanted it to be.
Well, and that's the thing. I will say this. The one compliment is, I will say there's one good shot, one moment of direction from Kevin Connolly that works, which is when the news of their son's passing is delivered by the doctor in the hospital way, where you have the basically the shot of Gotti himself way down the hospital corridor, while his family is closer up, but sort of in a haze filter, it almost seems like, sitting in a, just sort of in the waiting room area, and just him silently getting the news and watching Travolta play that scene. It's the one subtle moment of acting from Travolta in the film, and it is the one shot where it's like, okay, that works, Connolly. Good for you. Everything else is still terrible around this, though.
I think the bigger problem is that even though this sequence, certainly compared to the rest, feels the most tasteful and restrained, even, the problem is it really doesn't have anything to do with the movie's narrative as a whole. Because we very quickly get back to what is presumably the real thematic story, which is John and John A. You know, and like the idea of the deceased son never really gets raised again, only like by silent implication at one point. But I mean, like, further to that point, like, the John A story is chronologically all over the place and never really settles into, like, what did Gotti want for his son? Because at first, like, he seems to be proud of him that he's getting into West Point, and then admonishing him for getting in trouble at West Point and possibly getting suspended. And then his son says he wants to get into the life, and then he seems apprehensive, and then he yells at him for starting a bar fight. And then there's the scene where he's sworn in as a made man, and he's never been so proud of his son. And it's like, so what do you want for him?
Well, and that's the thing. And yeah, the one time Frankie's death comes back up is when John A is getting in trouble and Victoria is, or Vicky is yelling at John Sr. about, you promised me you wouldn't let him into the life, and that, and going on. And it's, again, it's like, well, yeah, but I mean, as you may have noticed at this point, John Gotti Sr., not a nice man, and not exactly good at keeping his word on things.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, later in the prison interview, there's one part where John A. quite rightly points out, he's like, Dad, my children are everything to me. If I lose my trial, I may never get to see them again, and I need to be in my children's lives. And, like, do you understand how hard it would be for me? And then Gotti's response is like, don't you dare make me say it out loud. And, like, that's it, where it's just like, you bring up your dead son solely to bully your living son into keeping his mouth shut and not seeing his children for 2 decades? So if, like, that's the only ultimate, like, function of this long protracted death scene, it's like, what purpose does it serve other than a way to therapeutically and safely express grief?
Well, and that's just it. And that's where, I on one hand, I feel bad sort of taking pot shots at this movie, because, yeah, I can see exactly why you're watching this movie, exactly why Travolta and Preston made it.
But, I mean, there's no right way to grieve. And, I mean, we can almost separate out this scene, though, because I guess the bigger question is, if you knew a guy who suffered a great tragedy, but all he did was stomp around and slap women and do whatever he wanted and tell everybody off, after what point do you stop making excuses for them?
Well, and that's the problem with this movie, because the rest of it is basically the validation of John Gotti Sr. and of Jr. And boy, oh boy, are the both of those wrong. Because, okay,
yeah, Sr. is never wrong in this film.
Yeah, not as he's, I mean, he's wrong. Everybody who's bringing a functioning brain to this film will be able to tell you, he is wrong in this film, but nobody who's made the film recognizes that he is wrong. And,
like, Neil tells him, don't whack Paul, the boss, that Neil dies. Yeah. And then he says, okay, we're going to whack Paul, the boss. It's kill or be killed. And all of his henchmen are like, okay, boss. And then, all right, I'm going to organize the family like this. Okay, boss. Okay, now I'm going to do this. Okay, boss. Oh, no, I'm under indictment. That's because the federal government's a bunch of goons. That's right, boss.
And this is where, like, again, like, okay. So in terms of the mafioso stuff, like, yeah, the whole what's happening to who and when and who gets somebody on tape, it's never very clear in this film, and there's no point in going through it scene by scene because nobody's really interested in it except for hand-waving away. It's like, ah, people are telling us we can't commit crime. Isn't that a tragedy? It's like,
The film's biggest mistake, though, is that, like, it focuses on the complete wrong part of it, because instead it gives us scenes of the generic goons being picked off one by one, because Vincent the Chin Gigante does not care for Gotti jumping the chain, and then there's the brief mob war. The film spends about 3 minutes talking about Vincent Gigante, which, in my mind, is a far more interesting film, because he was also a boss of an organized crime family, knew he was under federal surveillance, so what did he do? He basically walked around for the better part of 20 years in his bathrobe talking to himself to throw them off the scent and convince them that there's no way this insane guy could possibly be running his own crew. Yeah. And, like, it shows him in the bathrobe. It doesn't explain anything about that. It doesn't explain his history or how he ropes in other than him and Gotti don't get along, but they agree to do business together. And it's like, that's the much more interesting film.
Well, exactly. That's a much more interesting film. Or, at the very least, if you were going to make a film, as ostensibly this movie's trying to be, about fathers and sons and about Gotti Sr. and Gotti Jr., fine. Make that your focus. Unfortunately, when you actually see them bother to sit down and focus on that component of the film, oh my god, does everything fall apart here? Because, okay.
Well, it's not even clear that the filmmakers seem to know what they are trying to accomplish. Like, it feels like there are scenes with no idea for theme, and I think that's why it seems arbitrary at best and contradictory at worst.
But even, yeah.
You know, like, it's just because the second half of the film really does keep looping back to those interviews and sort of, like, that division between father and son. I mean, there are many junctures where they seem to be divided, but it seemed that was all smoothed away when you kind of got your son to join the mob.
Well, and this is the thing with, like, I mean, okay, let's even take about, even as bad as the writing is, it is bad. I mean, even, okay, you might still be able to film and put some of this together competently, you would think.
Give it a focus, for one. Talk about the mob war. Talk about his relationship with the son. Talk about his rise to the top. Talk about one of those things instead of talking about all of them inexpertly.
Exactly. And like I said, when it comes to the stuff with Johnny, like LaFranco, okay, he is not a strong actor to start with here, okay? You can tell, like, this is a guy who probably took as many acting classes as he could and has done all his homework to try and give this performance.
Yeah, he doesn't seem like he's phoning it in as much as he's doing his best, but it's just not a right fit.
Yeah, it's definitely not a right fit. But then you take a look at some of the choices that he is not responsible for that are made around him. Number one, putting aside the fact that he looks nothing like John A. at all.
That's a big one, yes.
Yeah. Number one, he starts playing the role of John A. in the late 1970s in this film. Okay?
This film
takes us all the way up to 2009 with him. All right? You would think that, okay, fine. Starting with his performances in the scenes in like 1978, 1979, every time we see him further on, he's going to get put up in a little bit more makeup. They're going to put a little more gray in his hair or maybe add a wrinkle or two here. Nope.
They gave him glasses.
Between 1979 and 1999, he did not age a day. And he has the same anachronistic haircut throughout all of it. He does not look like he's from the 1970s, okay? He looks like he belongs on the cast of Jersey Shore from back when that was on air the entire time. That is just...
Fashion like, sense, I guess, skips a mafia generation or something.
And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, then after, you know, we get into the very tail end of the film where it goes over very quickly John A's multiple trials and how he did not cooperate and he fought the government the entire way through.
Well, hang on, because we basically get Gotti, you know, sort of in prison at the end. Like, they finally bring the hammer down, the unfair, dirty, rotten federal government. And, like, this actually uses news footage of people, you know, admonishing the government for putting him in jail for racketeering and murder. But they use that same generic placeholder of, oh, the government gave them a raw deal, while never at any point explaining what was unfair about it. And I love that. You know, I love that because it's not a defensible position unless you can point to, like, evidence of prosecutorial misconduct, which is a real thing. But when it happens to people like John Gotti, I don't care as much. But then we get, like, you know, the montage of him keeping his spirit up in prison. And even though he's got cancer, you know, they're like, why don't you just let go? He's like, because every single day I got to go tell the government to screw themselves. Or they're like, the morphine isn't working. We have to put him on Ativan and that'll put him in a coma. Which, okay, maybe in huge doses. I've taken Ativan to calm down before a blood test, okay? I'm not in a coma. But then we see, like, his hand with that last bit of strength rise up and wag the finger.
Yeah, it is just embarrassingly bad.
And then we get it's followed by another completely insane montage of John A. suddenly taking over the film for the last 10 minutes, and we get his fight for justice.
Which, again, all we've seen of John A. at this point is that he's been he's nearly kicked out of West Point. He starts a bar fight, where somebody is killed in the process of it. Doesn't matter whether he threw the punch or not to kill the person. Yeah, we're still had a responsibility in this situation here.
Yeah, but remember, Ange says, look, I know you guys didn't do it, so it's cool. You just got a lot of brought a heat on this family.
Yeah, which that the film contradicts and says, well, actually, all the heat was coming down because of Angelo, who had apparently been caught on tape complaining in front of the feds, which is bonkers to me, where it's like, okay, so are they in trouble or are they not? Are we supposed to blame them? Like, what is going on at this point?
Were the police like, well, we were going to interview these two kids about that dead guy, but then we heard that Angela was talking on tape.
Well, exactly. And then oh my God. Let's talk about Angela for a moment, because if there's somebody I feel really sorry for in this movie, it is Pruitt Taylor Vince.
I do like Pruitt Taylor Vince. He has a distinctive face. He is never going to be, he was never leading man looks or even leading man personality, but I mean, he is a reliable character actor. Beautiful Girls, he was good in. Identity, who you will know as the as the killer, spoiler alert, he's good in that. You know, he's a very serviceable actor. I don't think he should be playing an old Italian man.
Well, my big thing is here is that he is so sincere in his performance. So, like, this is the guy, he's playing it like a puppy dog following John Gotti around at all times. And yeah. It doesn't matter what he does, he will defend it, which leads to the ridiculous scene when, basically in order to quote-unquote save his life, John Gotti puts him on a shelf, which basically means everybody has to turn their back on Angelo here, because, quote-unquote, if you follow the rules, everything's fine. And John Jr. doesn't understand it. When he goes to see Angelo, Angelo just says, like, don't you disrespect your father! Don't you do that! And, like, he is bringing the waterworks, he is bringing all the emotion he can to it, and it doesn't change how absurd and ridiculous the scene reads, no matter
what. Yeah. Similar to, like, a lot of the dialogue scenes between Stacey Keach and Travolta work well enough, and I think it's because the two guys can sort of, like, match their craft pretty well. But, I mean, even as well as Stacey Keach performs in this movie, you can't do much with lines of dialogue where it's like, you gotta secure the five boroughs, Staten Island, Queens, Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Manhattan. The five fingers will make your fist. It's like, what next, Stacey Keach? Take this sword and lantern. It's dangerous to go alone.
Well, the first of all, let's point out the fact that we have two New Yorkers talking to one another. Does he really need to explain what the five boroughs are to him? I mean,
also, does it explain why Stacey Keach is somehow Italian?
Yeah, but putting that aside, I mean, like, at least the thing with Stacey Keach and Travolta, and the reason why I think their scenes work to some degree, is these are guys talking shop, for the most part there.
Yeah.
What's at the level is like, okay, we're men of business, this is our jobs, we're professionals, we talk about it, we get into the goods. Like, and on that level, like, Keach and Travolta are able to deliver.
And those are the scenes, though, that seem, if this movie is about something, those are the scenes that give us the clearest indication of what it might be about. Because, like, this is the only time where they talk about, like, the philosophy of the life. The rest of the film is us just seeing the life be lived.
Well, and this is the thing. It's like, I mean, that would make a lot more sense if that was the focus. Or, I mean, but again, our frame narrative always brings us back to Gotti, father and son, and what, you know, basically sticking it to the government. And yeah, that is ultimately the note that this film will leave us on, where after John Gotti pulls off his assassination, and then takes charge of the five families there in New York City. Basically, the film has nothing else to really say about the criminal investigation of them. Like, yeah, no. It's not. And this is the thing. It's not even a case where we see, like, the investigative arm. Like, there's no representative of, okay, we're investigating the Gottis, and we got to take them down here, we got to take them down here. Like, it's all...
Yeah, it's just, it goes from, you know, you got your table at the Hilton, and, you know, they wave you past the guest list, you got that, and then the next day, it's, you're in a courtroom, and seated against you is the government.
Well, exactly. Here's the thing I think is really frustrating. Earlier this year, I watched the film Capone, from Josh Trank. And I don't know if you've seen that one.
I have not.
Okay. Whatever, like, that film was not really well received, but it's not terrible. In fact, I think it's kind of underrated. Not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But here's the thing that Capone definitely has over Gotti. It has a sense of focus and time and place. It is set during a very small snippet in the life of Al Capone. It is set at the very end, and it is very much, whatever else you can say, it knows thematically what it wants to say and what it wants to tell us about Capone as a figure in America. This film, again, is so all over the map. And, like, all it wants us to do is realize, hey, John Gotti was a really good man. And that's the thing that I can't...
Whoa, what a hell of a life that Gotti had.
Yeah, and this is what I don't understand. Like, look, I mean, I get one thing, like... Why I don't think John Gotti is somebody who's particularly interesting, that's not to say you can't make a film about him. And it's not to say you can't make a film about reprehensible people and put it on screen. That is entirely possible, and it's been done.
But they already
well.
Made those films about John Gotti. And I guess it's a question, like, what can you even do with his life story other than tell it?
Well, and I think that the angle they were taking was that this was going to be the Gotti father and son thing. This was going to be a family movie, but they never cracked that. They never found...
And like, the opening framing, I mean, the dual narrative confuses it further, because it's like, why do they have two of them? Because if it was simply framed by discussions at the prison, this film would be so much better. Instead, before any of that happens, we need to get Travolta alone, angrily yelling at the audience that he is a true American original, damn it, and we are going to respect him by the time it's done.
And what's more to the point here is, I mean, if this film had made the simple choice, tell it from the perspective of Gotti Jr., that would have simplified so many problems. Wouldn't necessarily make it a good movie, but at least you would be able to look at things and realize things like the hero worship that's going on is the perspective of somebody's son towards their father. And at least you could sit there and say that, okay, the film isn't so much praising Gotti so much as this is what, you know, his family saw him as, right or wrong. There. And instead,
the subjectivity of the narrative for an interesting purpose. And in recent years, some Superman writers have done stories, like miniseries from the perspective of Lex Luthor, and like as an artistic hook, they draw Superman to look very monstrous because that's how Luthor sees him. The film certainly has the potential to open a space like that, but it never does it, where it's like, we're interior to John Sr. sometimes, until he walks out of the movie, and then we objectively look at John Jr. take up this weird libertarian chaotic crusade for freedom. But then it ends on that closing coda, returning to John at the bridge again. And honestly, though, David, I know I'm skipping ahead to the ending, but I think that final coda is so deeply illustrative of the central problem with this film. Because do you remember what he says in that final line?
I honestly cannot.
Because it you think the movie's over, and then it cuts back to him literally for like a 10-second sequence where he turns to the viewer and says, "And I swear, you'll never see another one like me. If you live to be 5,000,
right, and then the film ends.
So first off, we've got two clear problems. First off, like, why would you jazz up the line like that? Wouldn't you say something like, if you live to be 100? Nobody lives to 5,000. That is that kind of unnecessary extra spin on the knuckleball that you can see like an overeager scripter throwing in without the sake of whether or not it sounds organic or makes any sense at all. But the second one, and I think the more damning point, is based off the film we have seen prior and all the events therein that literally are just an assemblage of tropes, a poor imitation of scenes we've seen done better in, say, Goodfellas or The Godfather, and all these other works that this film is clearly aping. What is it about John Gotti that we're never going to see again? What is it that he is referring to when he says that we'll never see another one like him? Because based on the film's presentation, there is literally nothing noteworthy about John Gotti presented in this film.
Well, that's absolutely. I mean, John Gotti, and again, it comes back to our point here earlier on, how many people honestly remember John Gotti?
Yeah, but it's that same defensive, like, oh yeah, you look me in the eye and tell me that I'm not important. It's like, but in order for that to work, you need to demonstrate it. Instead, like, right now we have Leonard Nimoy at the monorail, you know, we have Travolta turning to the audience and being like, yeah, now you've heard my story, go to hell, try and find another unique person like me. And it's like, but what uniqueness? You didn't do anything.
Didn't I?
Now that's an ending.
Yeah, but I mean, but you're absolutely right. And that's the bonkers thing. And the thing, but here's the thing. Here's the kicker to all of this, folks.
Okay.
And this is what boggles my mind completely. If this had simply been a bad movie, And there was a very good chance that we could probably all just have ignored this, and this would be some little weird obscure artifact that nobody talks about had its original planned release gone the way it was. Because here's the thing. This movie was supposed to be... the financiers of the film had an agreement in place with what's called Lionsgate Premiere. Now, I'm sure you're all familiar with Lionsgate. And Lionsgate Premiere is something that we've actually covered one of their films on the show prior. Aftermath with Arnold Schwarzenegger, which was a pretty darn good movie. Depressing as hell, but a pretty good movie. Premiere exists effectively as a distribution arm that didn't do really theatrical distribution. What it was supposed to do was primarily do sort of premium video on demand and direct-to-video releases for films that wouldn't necessarily, as they saw it, compete in the marketplace. And like some of them might get token, like we played on two screens, one in Los Angeles, one in New York. That sort of thing.
You know, if it's particularly noteworthy, we'll give it a gala night. We'll rent out Grauman's for the evening.
Yeah, something to that effect. Like, but that was the whole point. It was just supposed to be, this film was made, from what I understand, like a reported $10 million budget altogether, which explains the complete lack of period detail in most of this movie.
Yeah, because given the length of production, that seems astoundingly low. Not because this film looks expensive, but it's like, unless everybody was working to scale and like half the cast doing it pro bono, I don't see how that works.
Well, again, consider John Travolta, who else is cast in this movie? His wife, Kelly Preston, who probably was working for scale on this one. Leo Rossi, who worked on the script, was probably working for scale on this movie. Pruitt Taylor Vince was probably just happy to have a check, period. I mean, this is the thing. Like, this is not a star-studded cast on this one. So I could see it there and say, if most of these people shot their things in like 2 or 3 days, I could see this being made relatively quickly and cheaply.
That being said, David, this film also premiered at Cannes.
Well, I'm getting there.
Okay.
Here's what happened, folks. This was supposed to be released apparently in December of 2017 by Lionsgate Premiere as basically a premium video on demand title. Makes sense, you would think, right? Not a particularly great John Travolta film starring, basically a cast of actors who, again, they're not going to be guaranteed box office stars in this day and age at this point in time. Why not put it, release it that way, and then the diehards can see it and everybody else can ignore it and nobody loses their shirt by putting up a massive marketing campaign and creating a bunch of theatrical prints to go out to different theaters. Digital discs, I know, whatever. Or hard drives, you know what I'm talking about, folks.
Yes.
Point of the matter here is that apparently somebody decided that no. Gotti doesn't deserve that. So the production...
I just picture someone looking at the dailies and saying, no. Nope. No. You're going to be big, Travolta. Bela Lugosi big. I'm booking you tickets to France.
Well, and this is basically the production bought the film back from Lionsgate Premiere. Yeah. So they bought the production back from them, to which I'm certainly imagining Lionsgate Premiere saying, whatever. We get to keep our logo there one way or the other. But fine. They then, take this to Cannes and then come up with an agreement which includes the legendary Movie Pass company.
Remember that?
Yes. And it basically, in June, after the Cannes premiere, where this thing was slaughtered critically, they dumped this thing in theaters in June of 2018 with a massive marketing presence, demanding people come see the controversial films that the critics don't want you to see.
Well,
come
see, because it was released on about 500 screens, which I think is fairly low, and it wasn't screened to the critics in advance, which is usually a warning sign. And then I gather there was all sorts of controversy over vote bombing on Rotten Tomatoes and other critical aggregators. And most of it was IP traced back to the studio itself.
Well, there was that. And then there was the fact that MoviePass kept trying to convince people. It's like, no, people love this movie. They won't want to go to see it. Because they wanted people to see it, basically, because they had spent so much money backing this horse, which what the hell were you thinking, MoviePass?
Well, exactly. A 40% equity stake doesn't matter if you are making absolute garbage. Yeah. You know, it's like, do you want to be the emperor of the anthill that badly?
Well, I mean, I don't even think MoviePass is a thing anymore. I think they are officially out of business, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, man, we were really counting on that gaudy money.
Well, that's just the thing where it's like, why? I mean, and in the summer of 2018, I cannot remember exactly what was in theaters at that point, but I can guarantee it was probably a freaking Marvel film. In fact, I imagine Infinity War would have been still playing in theaters at that point in time. I don't care how much distance you put between yourselves, Gotti, and a Marvel movie. You were screwed.
Like, yeah. I mean, when you put it in those terms, though, I think you're right that it's more than just Travolta drinking the Kool-Aid here. Like, there's an entire network of people he's working with, and it seems at no point did anyone stop and look at things as they were. And had someone done so, I mean, you're right, this would have been an unremarkable film that was quietly shunted out on VOD. Maybe 10 years later, there would be a retrospective on, like, the oral history of the craziest film to never hit theaters, or something like that. And instead, this film basically Streisanded itself and did it in the most, like, in-your-face and confrontational kind of way that it pretty much cemented its own fate. Like, do you remember the video game Daikatana?
I know the title, but I'm not a hardcore gamer, so I can't say much beyond that.
Daikatana was, again, you know, a long-anticipated, long-delayed, and very expensive video game from some high-profile people. They famously took out a dual-page magazine ad that said, John Romero, lead designer, is gonna make you his bitch. And, like, the thing was, it was all marketed around, like, you're not ready. We're about to change the game. And they kept pushing it back and missing deadlines and that. Finally, it was ready to drop. And at that point in the pre-release, everyone's like, at this point, even if it's the greatest video game of all time that we have ever played, that's not going to be interesting because that's what we're conditioned to expect. And if it's anything less than that, then this is not going to be worth the time and anticipation put into this. And I believe that Daikatana's development cycle was probably about half the length of time it took for the film Gotti to get made and finally released.
Well, and the thing is at least, I don't know the video game industry terribly well, but I'm assuming that everybody who was involved in that film is legitimately a big name in the game scene, correct? Am I wrong?
Well, they were up until the time Daikatana came out, and then the studio went bankrupt.
Well, okay, but that's my point. It's one thing when, you know, if this had been, let's just say, again, let's use Capone here as our basis. You know, if Tom Hardy had turned around and sat there and said, no, I am insisting on theatrical distribution for this film, it's Tom Hardy in 2020. I kind of get it, okay? I'm not saying that would have been the smart decision to go with a wide theatrical release, but if there's somebody who can sit there and say, no, I'm a box office star. I was in Venom, folks, okay? You know what? You pay me to come see me.
I completely forgot that was a film that came out.
but this is the thing. Like, I at least get Tom Hardy being able to sit there and insist that, yeah, that's the horse we're going to back. John Travolta in 2018 is already well dug his hole into the ground by this point. He has to be aware that he is not an industry player in the way he was in the 90s. And more to the point, he has to be aware that, well, I say he has to be, but I'm trying to imagine being somebody involved in this film and sitting around and saying, it's like, you know what? This is going to be our ticket to the big time. This is going to put Kevin Connolly on the A-list.
They're thinking good things happened the last time Travolta had a film at Cannes, but that was also in 1994. You know, it's just like, I feel like this is a film of true believers truly believing, and in doing so, they become impossibly myopic to what they're actually creating.
I feel that John Travolta and Kelly Preston are true believers, and maybe even more so Travolta than Preston, as it were in this instance. But it's one of those things where, yeah, I imagine somebody had to have been backing John, and somebody had to have been the person who sat there and said, "Yeah, no, John, you're absolutely right. This needs to be seen on the biggest screen possible." Did he have a meeting with Christopher Nolan? It's like, no, the theatrical experience is the only thing that matters. John.
Maybe that's why it's so bad. But I mean, I guess maybe to wrap it up, I think what's most perplexing about this film is that, you know, we've encountered films that sort of are difficult to read or difficult to even make sense of. And whenever we are left with that, we sort of return to the basic question of who is this film for? And this is a case where I think first and foremost, this is a film for John Travolta. You know, in the same way that when we were looking at Blues Brothers 2000 with our friend Chris Martin, how like we kind of concluded that in some ways Dan Aykroyd's career can be explained by a guy who really misses his friend, but he's never like addressed it or acknowledged or allowed himself to grieve properly. So he keeps desperately like trying to play substitution games to recreate that. If this film is anything, it's clearly a very personal project to Travolta. But I mean, aside from the fatherhood angle, it feels like really what he's picking up on is like treating Gotti as a sort of stand-in for like manifest willpower. That, no, it doesn't matter what other people say about you. If you just stay the course, you will be proven right. And that becomes very dangerous when you apply it to real-world people, especially criminals. But at the end of the day, if indeed I am correct that Gotti is a film for John Travolta, first and foremost, it kind of begs the question of, does anybody else need to see it then?
The answer is no, although you're now basically prompting me to also think, are you basically saying that John Travolta is trying to make the other person's eyes black?
Maybe. I mean, that would be cooler than literally anything in this film. Yeah. It's just like, it's hard, because on one hand, I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for John Travolta. But on the other hand, that sympathy isn't so total that I'm going to keep excusing unforced errors. And, like, whatever sweetness there may be attempted to be cultivated in this film is drowned out by another hour and 55 minutes of toxicity and crassness surrounding it. Like, this is just an ugly and mean little film.
Well, yeah, no, you're not wrong whatsoever on that. And it's the thing. Like, this is just, it's a complete misfire from frame one. And there is legitimately, like, I will say, I wasn't bored while watching it, but this is
I
not...
was. There is no legitimate need for this film to be 2 hours long.
No, there isn't. I mean, this is the thing. Like, at least with Battlefield Earth, I have no problem recommending that film to people where it's like, you want to see some stuff where what the hell was everybody thinking? That isn't so bad, it's amazing.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
in a way.
The kind of film where you'll go, whoa, oh my god, and call your friends. It's like, you won't believe what just happened. This film never rises to that level.
And that's exactly the problem. And again, given what we know, what we can read as being John Travolta's motives for making it, that's probably a good thing it didn't do that, but that doesn't make it watchable for the rest of us.
Yeah.
So, if you want to watch Gotti for some reason, it's on Netflix Canada. I'm really recommending you don't do that.
And I mean, like we were talking about when we met up last week, it's difficult because, you know, not to say that we are absolute experts in our reading of this film, but if we are correct, like, that is kind of sad, and it is hard to watch, and it is difficult to watch people, like, go through the act of grieving. But it also begs the question of, is this really, at the end of the day, were you satisfied with the grieving that you brought forth? And I guess the only answer I can offer is, well, I hope that they were, because I certainly wasn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is not like, you know, Spielberg and Lucas excising their very strong emotions on the Temple of Doom set.
Oh, man. Yeah, so I think I think if we keep talking, we'll just have to, like, go into everything about the film, or we'll just end up feeling bad. So, Dave, I think maybe this is a good point to turn to our patent-pending bumper segment of Hits and Pits, where we celebrate and condemn the little things. And I have a feeling you and I are probably going to celebrate one thing and one thing only.
I might be able to come up with a second one, but let's hear your first one, because I'm pretty sure I know which one it's going
to
be.
Stacy Keach is the only one who seems to be acting, but also acting a character and not just like a paper-thin cutout of a mobster.
Yeah, now that's, like, Keach is, like, he is a seasoned pro
long
before he ever reached this point to begin with, and he is... Yeah, he really does deserve a much better movie than this. And
well, he's also a presence in the film. Like, when he is on screen, he has a sense of charisma and dynamism, even when he sits there inertly, that, like, the rest of the cast is just fairly inexperienced and fairly anonymous, and they just do not come anywhere close to having that same sense of command. So it really stands out.
Yeah, and that's the big thing here. If there's a silver lining to this movie, he certainly is that. In terms of anything else I can say that's kind of nice, again, I'm happy Leo Rossi seems so happy to be on set in this movie. Doesn't make the smug look on his face the entire time any more palpable, but it's like, good for you. You got two paychecks on this movie. Yeah. I mean,
Leo got paid. That's always a win.
Yeah. So, anything else, Andrew, any other hits for you?
I mean, on the one hand, part of me has a strange sort of respect for John Travolta, only because against all odds, like, if we are correct in our assumptions, that is still not an easy thing to do, to grieve as a public offering. And I think there's basically no way that you can do it and really pull it off in a way that everyone gets away clean, as it were. So the fact that you were simply willing to do that, I think, is admirable, if not necessarily advisable. And I mean, it's easy to dunk on Travolta for a lot of strange choices. If stories are true, though, I mean, I do have a lot of sympathy because, let's face it, I mean, just because we live in 2020 and the world is getting more progressive, that doesn't equate to it always being an open or a welcoming one, and old habits die hard. And the sad reality is, even in 2020, it is still very difficult for people to have spaces or communities where they can be themselves and feel validated and seen and loved. And if it is indeed the case that Mr. Travolta has not had that for most of his life, I can only sincerely hope that he does find that happiness. And that's the last thing I will have to say on that matter.
All right, then. Last hit for me, Chris Mulkey. I'm sure you got paid, you know, adequately for the 2 or 3 days you were on set, and you delivered a perfectly perfunctory performance in this movie. So that at least...
I kind of like Sammy the Bull.
He's all right, I guess. It's just, anytime you have a character named Sammy the Bull, it's like, all right, I already know exactly what this character is going to be, and let's go.
You're thinking of Ferdinand. But now that we've got our proper qualifiers out of the way, though, let's turn to the more fun part. Let's take Gotti to pieces. Dave, what's your first pit for this movie?
Remember how we said that this is technically a period movie? And by technically, I mean it's a period movie set over the course of 30 years, right?
Yeah, you can tell because every now and then there's an intertitle that says 1993.
Well, exactly. One of the things that's usually used to help communicate the notion of what era you're in is music. And, you know, famously seeing, like, Martin Scorsese films and using things such as in Casino, the Satisfaction by...
Devo?
Devo, yes, thank you. Wow, why was I blanking on that?
Or,
you
know, like, Layla in the murder montage in Goodfellas.
Exactly. I know Gotti wasn't a big-budget production. However, they spent their money on a certain composer for this film. Three, technically, but I'm assuming they were all working at the behest, most notably of one... Armando Christian Perez.
A.K.A. Mr. Worldwide?
A.K.A. Pitbull. Now, look, I actually, I'm not a, I don't know Mr. Pitbull's music terribly well.
Mr. Bull, I believe, Pitt is the first name.
The key thing here is that I've heard a couple of his songs. They're quite enjoyable. I liked the way in which he sampled Toto's Africa for the soundtrack for, the song he did for the soundtrack for Aquaman. So, and hey, his rap for Men in Black 3. Wasn't bad.
Hey, Dave, you're good. Really showing your appreciation here. I'm proud of you.
Unfortunately, this is a film about a New York mobster throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The Miami sound of Pitbull does not necessarily reflect New York City all that well to me.
I will go one further, Dave. Like, this soundtrack is beyond being bad. It is so generic to be formless. It sounds like MIDI music that they grabbed off a Creative Commons library. And I only really noticed it in the end credits, where I noticed Pitbull starts rapping about the events in the film. A la Men in Black, and there's a line where it's like, yeah, don't snitch me out, Sammy the Bull! And I'm like, what is... I'm okay, actually, not noticing the soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a confusing choice. And again, this is coming from somebody who's generally happy when big pop rock or musical acts are asked to do soundtracks. Tangerine Dream is amazing. I love the score for Death Wish 2 by, what's his face from Led Zeppelin?
John Paul Jones?
No.
Jimmy Page? Robert
I think
Plant?
It's Page, yeah. I think it's Jimmy Page, yeah, who does for both Death Wish 2 and 3. He does the scores for those ones. Two radically different scores, I might add, both incredibly memorable. And in fact, listen to the soundtrack to Death Wish 2. The movie itself is absolutely vile garbage, but that soundtrack, amazing. So yeah, I mean, like, this is the sort of thing that I would boast. Hell, I love Daft Punk doing Tron Legacy. Amazing score. This just doesn't work at all.
Well, like, it would be one thing because, like, Gotti, the character, is, like, written, like, he's supposed to be this larger-than-life figure. Where's our scene of him walking down a hallway into the Ritz-Carlton with his double-breasted suit with, like, the big, booming orchestral beat going behind him? Because we know Pitbull can do it. Why did they take their foot off the gas pedal?
Or why didn't we have a scene of John Travolta walking down the street while we hear the Bee Gees talking about walking down the streets? You can tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman's man. Nope, I'm the talk.
I think we all saw where that joke was going. But yeah, the problem is, David, that that was one of the few movies that they didn't pay homage to in this one. Yeah, I would say I have to give a special pit to editor Jim Flynn. looking over their credits, they worked on things like Dear Eleanor, Atlas Shrugged Part 1, and Cruel Intentions 2. This film's script is bad in terms of temporal and spatial location. The editing makes it even worse. This film is a chore to reconstruct or follow along with. Like, it's not a case of non-linear editing. This is a case of just poor editing.
Yeah, no, this is, it's embarrassing. Like, it's really, really clunky and confused. And again, I know he's only working with the footage he has, but this is one of those instances where if somebody sat there and said, make it less than 90 minutes, we would all probably have been very happy at the end of the day.
Well, exactly. Because, I mean, never underestimate the power that a good editor can have in terms of helping focus material down and help discover sort of what those themes are and, like, bring them forth from the material. That doesn't happen here. And in fact, the way that it does actually makes any thematic exploration of the film even more confusing. And you are right, David, because this is a film where it feels like nothing got cut out, and was it David Bordwell, or maybe it was Robin Wood, who said that the problem with grand theory is that any theory that's so broad as to be applicable to everything ultimately says nothing of consequence about anything. And this feels like a film where at every step of the way, when asked what this movie was going to be, we're making a movie about Gotti. And that's all that was ever put into it. And so the end result is a movie about Gotti and everything that happened to him, but it's not really about anything.
Yeah. Now, I will say the following with fairness to Jim Flynn. When you look at his credits and what he's all worked on previously, I don't get the sense that this was a guy who was in a position to be able to sit there and say no to anyone.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, Jim Flynn, we're blaming you, but not really. I'm sure your family thinks you're very nice.
Well, I'm singling him out because all this movie took was like one or two people saying no. Jim Flynn, you could have made a difference, and you just stood there.
And Jim, you fired. And okay.
You'll never work in this town again.
Well, yeah. But on the second sort of pit note here, I know I kind of singled him out earlier in the film, and it feels bad to do it again, but Spencer LaFranco, the reason I'm coming back to him is that as bad as this film is, and again, as much as he is clearly trying his heart out to make this work, he is also very clearly not a ready-for-primetime player at all. And now, granted, this is not a ready-for-production script or at all at any point in this thing, but at least everybody else who's in this film is at least a seasoned pro, or at least doing something where it's like, well, choices were made. Like, I don't like John Travolta's work here, but choices were made in terms of his performance, terms of when he was going to go big. LaFranco is just like, and again, all my sympathies to him. I can imagine being a young working actor, and it's like, you're going to basically be getting the second biggest part in this movie beside John Travolta.
Yeah, but that only really emerges in the second half. So I feel like whoever was in charge of casting simply read the first 50 pages of the script and said, oh, you know, that kid was in the background, let's cast this guy. And only later they're like, oh, they have to do a lot of heavy lifting.
Well, and it's the thing where you could sit there and say, well, he's a young up-and-coming actor. I mean, it's a young part.
He certainly was.
Well, and this is my thing where it's like, look, I get that it's a young part, but when you consider that you're asking me to buy 60-year-old John Travolta as, you know, 30-something John Gotti back in 1973, at a certain point, the idea of realistic casting ceased to matter here. Again, cast like, you know, even Dave Franco, okay? You know, I mean, he's technically a more competent actor. He would be probably slightly more physically closer to John A. than LaFranco is here. And you still get Franco as part of the name. So, see, everybody wins here.
Yeah.
Except the audience. But,
exactly.
I mean...
Yes. Oh, man. Well, I mean, this was a film where... I knew we would be plumbing depths. Didn't quite realize how dark it would get, but I am glad, though, that we never have to come back this way again. And on that note, I do see some light coming through at the end of the tunnel. Dave, why don't you tell me what lies on the other side of that light? Where are we going next?
Well, a part of the cast is the late Kelly Preston, and I would like to tell you that we're going to a film which is going to demonstrate her skills as an actor much better than this one did. However, having seen the film for next week, I can confirm that she doesn't get much more to do. That said, we are following her all the way back to 1986 for the one, the only, John Frankenheimer's adaptation of the Elmore Leonard novel, 52 Pickups, starring a returning Roy Scheider,
and
Margaret, John Glover, and, why am I blanking on the rest of the class? Anyways, you'll find out next week who else was in this movie. It's an amazing, amazing little thriller that we're going to be getting to. Yes, I'm tipping my hat shortly.
At least after sitting through a very pedestrian, wannabe, hard-nosed thriller, I'm glad we can get back to the uncut supply. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Because if anyone knows how to do cinema sleaze, it's Frankenheimer and Roy Scheider.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm honestly surprised that it's taken us this long to get to Michael Bay's dad. Or supposed dad, theoretically.
I'm sure I'll have a lot of questions for you next week. If you have questions and don't want to wait that long, though, where can people get in touch with Dave on social media?
Why, you can find me at 24 Panels. I'd be happy to have a conversation, except with members of the Gotti family, probably members of the Travolta's legal estate, and anybody else who may want to come after us. Andrew, what about you?
Postcards to me. You can find me on Twitter at FilmStripper, and you can also email our show directly at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And as always, feel free to rate and review us in iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use. Helps us move up the featured chart and get new listeners for our show. And it's yet another place where you can leave us some feedback. What works for you? What doesn't? Maybe the guy should watch better movies. Maybe Dave should just record by himself. We won't try it until you tell us to think about it.
Yeah, we're not doing the recording by myself thing, folks. Trust me, it's better for all. Andrew, do you have any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Why, Dave, I'm so happy you asked, and yes, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Beware the steakhouse. Bye.
I should have said whack. Oh.